Welcome to the third edition of the No Ripcast, the podcast brought to you from the people at independent film and music magazine, NoRipcord.com. I'm Joe Rivers, features editor. Our usual person who joins us in the podcast today, David Coleman, managing editor, is away doing, well, he's getting married. So congratulations to him and his new wife. So today I'm joined by managing editor Juan Edgardo Rodriguez.
Hello.
And music editor Sean Caldwell.
Hello.
Okay, so best place to begin is probably the start. So the usual question, everyone, what have you been doing? What have you been listening to over the past 4 weeks or so? Juan, would you like to start?
Sure. How about I'm going to talk a little bit about what I've been listening to these days and also what I did yesterday. Yesterday I went to the FYF Festival, translated, or I think it was formerly translated to Fuck Yeah Festival. I don't know if that's still...
I'm pretty sure that's accurate. I think that's the same.
I think it's still the official name, and it was... it was a nice festival. I've never really gone to any of these festivals before. Like I said, where I come from, we usually don't have these types of rock festivals. And if it's not that, it's usually like festivals for like salsa, salsa or like ballads or balladeers. And we usually do, since that's the core audience where I come from, we usually don't get rock podcasts. So it was mainly my first big festival being in LA and all. And, besides almost not listening right now through one ear, I had a pretty good time. I mean, a lot of good bands. And I have to say that some of the ones that I enjoyed most were probably Abbott Buffalo. I think they did a great job. And they were one of the first acts to come out. They were on the bill really early, but they really have something special in them. I mean, they still haven't really developed their voice, but I heard some of their new songs, and I think this is a band that probably holds a lot of promise, probably more than many of the other bands that were in the bill who were just starting out.
I'm looking forward to that second AV Buffalo album quite a lot, actually, whenever it's due to come out. I've no idea, but... It should be good.
And they're just a bunch of kids doing really sophisticated music, and you can really listen to it by not only their energy but their song arrangements and their progressions are really well done. And I don't know, besides that, probably my highlight of the night was watching the rock, not lo-fi version of Guided by Voices, which I had never seen before, and it was quite an experience because they're all a bunch of, they were just showing the kids how it's done, they were drinking cigarettes, they were like smoking cigarettes while singing and playing, and they were right a raucous bunch. I mean, it was, they were just, really caught a really magical energy in there that I had never expected from a band who usually obfuscates their instrumentation mostly because of the recording techniques they use, but really carried an audience. And right at the end, unfortunately, I was about to leave and I saw a little bit of Explosions in the Sky, which was pretty enjoyable, but I wanted to see the Dead Milkmen too, so I needed to, I saw half of one and half of the other, and both totally different experiences, but it was great to watch a band that I used to listen to in my childhood and a band that just really blows it out of the water, alive, like Explosions. So that was probably the cap of my night. I mean, a few things that weren't that eventful, but it's really something not worth talking about.
I was going to say, was there any band in particular that broke your ear? Or is that was it just the overall sort of experience from the day?
I don't know. It could be. I mean, probably like some acts that I... were close to being insufferable were this band called Twin Sister. I really hadn't known anything about them, perhaps, besides a performance or two. a review here and there, and they were, I don't know, I really didn't like them because they had like this really loungy, like synth pop thing, and the lead singer was so lackadaisical that you couldn't even understand what she was singing, and she was all precious, being all precious, like, oh, hello, and, you know, I'm being like this, and I couldn't really stand that. It was horrible. I mean, I don't know about Twin Sister. They had a few good songs here and there, but it wasn't a great first introduction to the festival.
Oh, they were the first band you saw, were they?
They were the first band I saw, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So what have you been listening to then over the past few weeks?
Well, I've been listening to... I actually listened to, like, 2 or 3 days ago while I was commuting. I listened to the new Slow Club, and it had really good songs. I mean, Slow Club is the kind of group that I can't really point with a genre. I mean, they really do a lot of different things. I'm not really crazy about their acoustic tracks, but they have a few nice songs in this new album, I have to say. I know that you like them a lot, Joe.
I'm a very big fan, yeah.
Yeah, so you could perhaps elaborate on it when you review it in the future. And besides that, I've also reviewed the new Cymbals Eat Guitars album, which I guess it's the sort of album that sort of makes me think that that people undermine what being objective means, because it's not an album that I strongly feel that I would listen to a lot, but I felt like I gave a better score because I felt that objectively speaking, it's really well done and really well written, but I don't know if I listen to it all the time. It's a really, really ornate listen. I mean, their lyrical content comes almost close to being on the verge of really, really annoying. Because they tend to be really dense with their lyrics and really, really heavy on their prose. And I guess it's the sort of band that you have to sort of block that out, but listen to the influences that they come from, and that they're actually doing they're doing new things with a musical palette that is really traditional, which is 90s, alterna rock. But besides that, I still feel that they're doing new things. But yeah, there's always that prose that just gets to me for some reason.
It's an interesting question, though, because there's always the aspect of artists or albums that are easier to appreciate than necessarily enjoy. And the ones you enjoy, the ones you go back to time and time again, and the ones you appreciate, you can sit listening to it and thinking, yeah, this is really good. I can see why this is good, but it's not perhaps moving you in the way that some other, perhaps less cerebral things might do, I guess.
Exactly. It's not an emotional experience at all. It's mostly something that you can listen to, well, pretty loudly, or something that, you know, that really sets an energy on a live feel, probably. But I don't know. There's something about the music there that they feel like they're being complicated for the sake of being complicated, and I still don't know if it feels like completely genuine, but I still, in terms of production, I can't fault it because I think it's a great album.
I think I've seen them live last year. I can't remember. I went to see the Hold Steady, and I think they were supporting. And from what I can remember, is that they took themselves very, very seriously, and it was quite clever and put together nicely, and all the tracks built up quite well. But you could kind of see you could see what they were trying to do, and you could see sort of crescendos and big climactic parts of the record coming from like a mile off. It was a strange one in that it was, as I say, it was quite well crafted, if you like, but at the same time a bit obvious and cliched was my very brief opinion on them, really.
It's like I sort of hinted in the review, they're sort of students of the game now, and I'm probably they seem like the band that is so well crafted that in the next 20 years they'll probably like form a record label and hire bands that sound just like them. I don't know, they seem like that type of band that was growing to their 40s, still doing these types of albums and recruiting younger people to make these types of albums. And since critics tend to be really lenient with this type of music, I guess they'll back them out no matter what.
That sounds terrific. You've just cast a vision of some kind of dystopian future of simple Z guitar clones, and we won't be able to escape.
But I think that exists now. That dystopian some genres are more favored than others. I've always thought so. In the critical perspective of things.
I guess so, yeah. We should probably remember we're doing this, because we like music and listening to music rather than just spotting trends that make us sad. Sean, I might pass over to you now. What have you been up to and what have you been listening to?
Well, I guess kind of in the vein of what Juan was talking about with, craft kind of outdoing passion, I've been listening to Empty Space Orchestra recently. Because they had a self-titled album that came out earlier, like around May, but then they put out a 2-song EP a couple weeks ago that's download only.
Okay.
And so I ended up coming back to the self-titled album, and I just because of the feeling of the album and how they produced this second just 2-song, it's only 18 minutes, but it seems stronger, less reliant on studio, and it just seems like a closer translation of what kind of sound you get when they perform live. But what I find remarkable about them is that they do kind of embrace that, the music is academia or rock is academia approach, but they also have enough passion that, you could find them appealing to, blues garage types or psych fans or, anybody along those lines. I mean, they do also add space and psychedelia and stoner elements to what they do too. So, it's good because they kind of avoid, the pretension that is typically associated with that kind of, progressive music, I should say.
Yeah, I find the stuff like that, if it's a bit too pretentious and worthy, you sort of end up feeling it's a little bit like it's a bit like a party that you're not invited to. It's quite distant for the listener.
Right, and that's, kind of what, that's why rock had to kind of reduce itself back to its roots in 77, just because everyone felt disconnected. You can give the music credit because it is amazing music. It's amazingly well done, but, after a while, it just does become all about the math, not necessarily about the music. I've been digging them, and Hella's last album I reviewed, and I really liked that too. The new Mogwai I was actually really surprised, or, pleasantly surprised about. It's only 4 songs, but I thought it kind of separated itself once again from that, the archetype, or the, template, the post-rock template.
Yeah, they're one of these bands that just seem to keep innovating, and they seem to stay fairly under the radar in the sort of mainstream world, if you like. But, is this already their second album of the year, or their second at release in 12 months at least, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, they put out the Hardcore Will Never Die, But You Will. And then this is, this was apparently runoff from those sessions. But it gels well. It almost seems like they purposely set out to make this EP. And like I said, it's only 4 songs, but it does make kind of an interesting statement within 4 songs.
Okay, cool. Anything else to add, or shall I bore you all with my list of stuff I've been listening to?
I'm intrigued, please.
Really? You're too kind. No festivals or gigs really to speak of over the last 4 weeks. But after our last podcast, where we listened to a bit of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop and some of the more, analog electronics, and I suppose it's almost sort of public information film style music. I purchased a sampler from a label called Ghostbox Records, who specialise in bands who put out all this sort of stuff as 3-minute pop songs, if you like, rather than 10-second sound effects sequences. So it's about 3 years old, the sampler. It's called Ritual and Education, and I've been listening to that quite a lot. It's got some, it's got bands like The Advisory Circle and Banbury Polly. I'm talking like I know these bands. I'd never heard of them before I downloaded this record. But it's something which is certainly very interesting. And as was mentioned on the last podcast, feeds forward, if you like, maybe, into my love of bands like Stereolab and Broadcast, who like to make antiquated sounding electronic music, I guess. In a completely different style of things, I bought an album of a compilation called La Belle Époque, which is French female singers that were signed to EMI between the years of 1963 and 1966, which sounds like I'm now being obscure for obscurity's sake, but that's also really it's quite interesting. It's got a definite different feel to the Phil Spector 1960s girl group stuff that was coming out of America at the time, but there are still lots of parallels between it as well. Other than that, I finally got into the new Braids record about 6 months late, I think, and I'm quite enjoying that. I don't know if either of you have heard this record, but there is a reggae singer called Little Roy who's just recorded an album entirely of Nirvana covers. Have either of you heard that?
No, I haven't heard that.
I haven't heard of it.
Okay, it's called Battle for Seattle, and it works surprisingly well. It's quite varied. I mean, a lot of the time my gripe with reggae, if you like, is that it's quite similar sounding, but there's some real variation along the 10 tracks here, and the choice of songs themselves is actually very good. He's avoided the obvious by there's no version of Smells Like Teen Spirit on there, which I guess would be the, you know, if you're making an album of Nirvana covers, that's probably the obvious one you go for, and I'd be quite intrigued to know why that one isn't on there.
Actually happy that one's not on there.
Oh yeah, I know it's done to death completely, but it'd be interesting to know if that was, you know, the reason is because it's been done to death, or just, you know, they tried it and it didn't quite work, or be quite interested to learn what's going on behind there. But that's inspired me to listen to a few reggae compilations via the magic of Spotify. And then, other than that, just lots of slow club, really, as Juan mentioned earlier. I have their new album, Paradise, which is I'm completely, madly in love with their first album, Yeah So, which came out about 2 years ago, I think. And Juan, you mentioned they're quite difficult to bracket, and so normally I'd say, well, let's not. But I guess if you don't know them, they're, I suppose, folk pop, twee folk, something along those lines, or at least their first album was. But this is a bit more of a grown up, sort of beefed up sound, I think. They sound like they've grown into being a band quite a lot more. And their first record was sort of very, very youthful. There was lots of, it's the kind of record I think it could only be a debut record. Lots of, almost like they couldn't believe they'd been given the money to go and make their own record, but this one, it's different, but still in a very good way. It's a very enjoyable thing to listen to, I'd say.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that album is that it has a progression in terms of the percussion. I don't know if you heard that, like the percussion is really prominent, and they bring like some Caribbean percussion in there to their songs, which I thought was intriguing, to say the least.
Okay, I think we can end part one there. Okay, welcome back to part two. And part two this week, or this month, I should say, is the No Ripcord debate. Now, in the last month, we've seen the sad deaths of both Nicholas Ashford of Ashford & Simpson and Jerry Leiber of Leiber & Stoller, two of the most influential songwriting teams in the history of popular music, say. Ashford & Simpson wrote a lot for the Motown stable, nearly all of Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell's hits, before going on to a career as performers themselves. Leiber & Stoller, most famous for some of Elvis's best-known songs, Hound Dog, Jailhouse Rock, and also wrote Stand By Me for Benny King. This sort of brought to mind, really, the fact that songwriting teams such as those two and Bacharach and David, Holland, Dozier, Holland, were quite common and back in the day, if you like. And now it seems that people are very reluctant to sing songs that were written for them. And there's much the talk of authenticity and realness by writing your own material, and only the person who writes the material performs it. It's a sea change in opinion that, taken in stark terms like that, may seem slightly bizarre. So, Sean, what do you think about that? Any particular thoughts or reasons why you think that might be?
I think you still have pop artists who rely heavily on songwriters. I just don't think they're songwriters anymore. I think they're production teams. So, I mean, you have a lot of, pop artists who rely on the Neptunes or, you know, Kanye or, you know, somebody like that. We seem to kind of revolve around producers as music makers now. And I just think the concept of traditional songwriters writing songs for, pop artists is just kind of, it's just different now. That's all. I also think though that, to call on, I guess, questioning the authenticity of these, production teams or writers or people, you know, who, performers who don't write their own songs. I mean, you look at it a bunch of different ways. You had people like Bob Dylan who could write his own songs and other people's songs too. And you have people who could, and you know, you have performers like that, and then you have performers like Marvin Gaye, I mean, who, you know, probably had things written for him, but could add his own, you know, his own take on it, you know, unique style and all. I mean, the guy could make songs his own.
Yeah.
And then you have, it's weird because then you have Elvis Presley, you know, who was also very influential, who really didn't write any of his stuff either. But then the Beatles came along and were ridiculously, they were seminal. They've changed the landscape completely, but they were also a rare instance at that time of a band that wrote its own songs.
They were towards the end, but really, I mean, their first few albums have got almost as many covers as original compositions on.
Yeah, agreed. But, I mean, they stopped, I think Rubber Soul was their first fully written album. So that was like from 65 to 70. But, I mean, in the meantime, those were the songs that, you know, changed the landscape. Or the albums that changed the landscape, I would say. I think credibility gets called in just because, I mean, I remember reading a story about Kim Gordon. Her daughter was listening to Britney Spears, and Kim Gordon brought up to the daughter that, you know, Britney Spears didn't write these songs. Some old guy wrote these songs, and then she no longer liked Britney Spears. So, I mean, I just think that might have more to do with the authenticity aspect of, like, who's writing these songs.
Yeah, my personal view on that is I think the end product, the song, is the important thing. And, you know, as long as no animals or children or whatever were harmed in the making of the song, I'm not really bothered as to who wrote it, really. I mean, I'm interested from a perspective of I find that quite interesting and you can seek out similar things. But if I like a song, then I think I like a song. And whether the artist wrote it themselves or it was some old guy writing it, that's really immaterial to me, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I see that point. I mean, like I said, I do think it's production teams versus songwriters nowadays. And I don't know if that makes the music less genuine, but maybe it's quality too. I mean, I do think that some of those songs written for people years ago were much better than they are now. But well, I mean, that's just a personal take.
Yeah, I'm interested in what you mean as to make them less genuine. I mean, what makes this genuine or not, do you think?
Maybe it's Marvin Gaye versus some, you know, R&B performer who relies heavily on autotune. You know, I mean, it could just be performance has become plastic and maybe therefore, you know, maybe therefore the fact that these singers don't write their own songs comes into question.
But would it be any more genuine if there was a sort of heavily auto-tuned R&B 20-something who had actually written all their own material? Would that make a difference, do you think?
I think you add autotune to anything and it immediately becomes just kind of plastic and it does seem like these performers hide behind that. So, I don't know. It could just be that music these days is production versus songwriting. I mean, how important is the songwriting when the production takes care of everything?
I see your point. I'm partly playing devil's advocate here, but I think autotune is just, it's another instrument. It's another thing you can do in terms of production. I mean, there are some songs that have been completely overtaken by autotune and completely ruined by it. But then you see something like, I don't know, say James Blake, for example, or sort of producers who are actually, you know, using autotune to make interesting effects and actually using it to push the boundaries and see what can be done, rather than just use it to, I don't know, make something sound like a Black Eyed Peas song, I guess.
Well, I mean, it could just be that the market is so ridiculously saturated right now with autotune that everything is becoming, or everything does kind of sound the same. I mean, I guess it's kind of like, it's along the lines of Afrika Bambaataa using a vocoder years ago, but that was new back then. So, I mean, he could at least kind of make that work for him, and it worked for the music he was making. Now it just seems like everybody uses it. I mean, even Bon Iver uses it, you know?
Yeah.
It is kind of just overly used, and it doesn't help anybody sound distinguished from any other performer. I mean, everybody sounds the same on the other end of that device.
Just thinking of the sort of strange parallel in that if Afrika Bambaataa was the sort of the pioneer of things in the 80s, then the logical follow-on from that is that the pioneer in the 90s was Cher, because I think that was the first sort of widely popular auto-tune song with Believe.
Yeah, it's the first time. It's the first time I remember ever hearing that. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, there we go. Share the people.
She's a pioneer, and we didn't
know
it.
She's a pioneer. Yeah. Next month will be a Share special. Juan, what do you think about all this? And if you can get us away from the subject of Share, that would be fantastic as well.
Awesome. I sort of have like a divergent shift here, because at first, you sort of remember that, or we didn't remember because we weren't born yet, but in the 50s and in the 60s, I would say that, you know, it was basically like this monopoly of songwriters, like, let's say, Jerry Lieber, Mike Stroller, and they would, you know, co-wrote songs for a lot of the, you know, a lot of the 50s tunes that you would listen to, like, on the day, like Love Potion Number 9, and those, you know, those sort of tracks that are really unforgettable, but you sort of remember them because of the songs themselves, not who sung them, in a sense, or performed them. And, you know, same goes for bands like the Four Aces, stuff like that, I mean. And then when the early 60s came, like, artists like Sean mentioned, Bob Dylan and Joan Baez came in, and they sort of upped the game, you could say, because they hit the, you know, they hit the pop charts, just like all these artists were, but there was this emphasis on they were, you know, being more quote-unquote authentic than all these other artists, and it also influenced a stream of artists to come afterwards. Like, you would say, like, Simon and Garfunkel were influenced by them, even Joni Mitchell, and, you know, and in a sense, they were sort of, you could see that it was a different, you know, it was something really different than all these other artists. I mean, at least coming from the perspective of the 50s and in the 60s, in contrast to how it's sort of managed these days. And even bands, I mean, didn't the Yardbirds didn't even write their own songs until like 1966 or 1967. I think it was Roger the Engineer was the first album that they actually wrote. And this band is known for artists like, you know, well, Jeff Beck or Jimmy Page and all these artists that are known as songwriters, but and such a band like the Yardbirds that is known more for the image of the band itself, and they didn't even write their own songs at first. You know, you sort of have to go back and think, you know, was it really that important for bands to really write their songs on that heyday, I guess.
Well, that's the thing. You've both made good points that I can very much agree with, but there's always a sort of nagging suspicion in the back of my mind that there's just a bit of sort of rock snobbishness about the whole thing, and, you know, write your own songs good, get someone else to write your songs bad.
No, there is. I mean, there's definitely an elitist attitude toward it. I mean, there's no denying that at all. I mean, it's not to say that someone who, you know, a lot of these bands have done good cover songs.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, that's happened too. So, I mean, it's not necessarily, I don't know. I can't tell if it's an inability for these artists to kind of add their own stamp to this music, or if it just feels like it's, regurgitated. I think that ends up kind of calling to question the authenticity when it just feels like it's everywhere and not necessarily leading to any kind of distinguished or, you know, enhanced performance.
Yeah, and I guess sometimes it really depends on if you have a really powerful artist or a powerful voice. Like somebody like Dusty Springfield never wrote a song that I'm aware of, but she would transmit so much emotion to her songs that you really felt like it was her songs.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, we're always in, like, I think that record labels now, they're sort of trying to search for auteurs in a sense in the pop spectrum, and you have a lot of interesting artists, like coming to someone like Janelle Monáe, for example, that she would Chuck Lightning, she has a team as well, but you can sort of see that she writes her songs with Chuck Lightning, and that's, you know, some collaborations are really, really fruitful in that sense. But I remember that, I never really was a fan, but somebody like Norah Jones, who really had this posture about her, like, let's sell her like this auteur, like I was saying, she probably wrote like half her songs. And it was sort of surprising to me because she really felt that this was like a really genuine musician. But then again, you know, what's really the difference of what's genuine or not? But in her camp, like sort of the bluesy, jazzy songs that she brings to her music, it was sort of disappointing. I really thought that she really carried her own, I guess you would say.
Yeah, I think she was helped marketing-wise by the fact she's Ravi Shankar's daughter as well, so she was instantly, if she's his daughter, she goes in the proper artist category rather than, you know, manufactured pop star. And the fact that she's not unattractive is just gonna help. Rather than explicitly market that because she's proper artist, I'm doing all these with air quotes, which doesn't really come across very well. But, yeah, so, that, you know, it can sort of help under the radar, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a whole lot of work she has to do to kind of put across her authenticity. I mean, I do think she's a decent songwriter. I do think she has a decent voice, and I do like some of her songs. But, yeah, they're, just because of her legacy, she doesn't really have to do a ton to kind of appease people.
Yeah, I think she was a victim of her own success, really, with the first album. I mean, I think everybody on the population of the world each bought that album 3 times, I think. So the sales-wise, it was never, ever going to live up to that. So everything she does is sort of subsequently seen as a commercial failure, I guess, rather than knowing how, rather than wondering the actual quality of the record is any good or not. Okay, I think we'll end part 2 there. Didn't actually come to any conclusions, apart from Cher is a musical pioneer who should be celebrated. So,
T-Pain should send her a thank you card.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
At the auto-tune convention.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and this is sort of like the tendency we're going here. Like, next week it's Cher, and I promise you that the next week it'll be Barbara Streisand. I promise you guys.
I will not let that happen.
Yeah, that can't happen.
No, not happen. Suede, next week it's Suede. Okay, we will actually end part 2 there. Hey! You're listening to the No Ripcast. Welcome back. This is part 3. It's a show and tell feature where one person in the pod brings in something for the rest of us to listen to, something a little out of the ordinary, something that isn't necessarily everyday listening, and we discuss what we think of it. So, this month, Juan is in the driving seat, so I shall now hand over to him.
Well, for this week's installment, I'm going to tell the story of pioneering, or to some people not really, Swiss punk scene from the period of 1976 to 1980. Basically, this was a scene that grew from the influence that started in London and in New York that we love and cherish, that is called the punk scene of the late 70s. And in a way, Swiss punk was sort of a movement that emerged in the cities of Zurich and in Geneva. And it's charming because it tells a completely different story from this politically and deeply political movement that came in that time from the punk movement as well. But in a way, I sort of see that the energy of the Swiss punk movement is sort of mimicked, but in a way, it also brings this artistic, I would say abstract, these abstract ideas of what punk was, and they brought it into a movement that really wasn't even a movement. It was just a bunch of young kids who wanted to express themselves in a way that was more genuine and bring it to that, even if it's not still really known. I think the only band that really emerged from that era as popular was the band Lilliput, which was a girl group that came from the late 70s, and I think they were acquired by Rough Trade Records, and I think that's the only popular Swiss band. But I wanted to show a few snippets of some bands that were from the Swiss punk movement, but perhaps are still lesser known to the cusp of the punk movement in the late 70s.
There was four tracks that you sent over us to listen to. There was Lost and Found by the Nasal Boys, I Remember 77 by TNT, Der Mond by Hertz, and Bombs by Sperma. Listening to them, really, I mean, straight off the bat, I will confess, punk isn't hugely my thing. It's, a lot of the time it's something I haven't got too much time for. I tend to a lot of the time think, if you were there, it was great, and I wasn't. So that is my very reductive view of punk. But just listening to those, I was surprised at the quality of them and how they stood up to stuff from the UK and American movements, and just wondered why they weren't as well known, really. There's no reason that I can see that as to why these weren't as popular. The other thing I think of, I mean, there was some association, slightly, this is probably being grossly unfair to a lot of the people involved, but there was always some connection with punk and the far right movement in the UK. So just wondering that if that meant that foreign bands weren't exactly going to be embraced and taken under the wing of the UK bands as they might have been in another movement or another time. But that's a real finger in the air theory. That's just off the top of my head, really. So, yeah, as I said, the quality of them was stood up well with anything else, I think. The one thing I found quite amusing is that the TNT song was called I Remember 77, which obviously being about punk and the birth of punk, but was recorded in 1980. So I'd be worried if they didn't remember 77 at that point, to be honest. But that was my observation on it anyway.
Yeah, and sort of going back to that, I sort of picked these tracks because they sort of pinpoint different movements, they would pinpoint different stylings, you would say, that sort of derive from what punk was and it has become. Because a band like Nasal Boys sounds terribly post-punk to me. I mean, like, they sort of had this feel that you really listen to in bands like Gang of Four or even Wire and all these bands. And TNT were more of the more traditional camp, I would say. And even a band like Hertz were part of this genre called Alpine Punk, which was, if you've heard, it sort of had this prog rock influence to it as well. But it also was marking the entrance of new wave for these people. And the interesting thing about the Swiss punk movement, I would say more than anything else, is that they were sort of defying in a different way. They weren't defying, in a violent way. I guess they were sort of defying this. Swiss music in that era in the mid-70s was really marked by really progressive and experimental bands, and it was just a way of being more immediate, I guess.
Yeah, the thing with that Hertz track in particular, I actually thought that was quite ahead of its time, really, for considering when it was recorded. What you mentioned about Alpine punk, I did a bit of research on this. I didn't get to hear any, but according to the fountain of all knowledge that is Wikipedia, apparently Alpine punk, or sometimes called Alpunk, is punk but mixed with accordion-heavy local folk music, which sounds horrific, actually, in one sense. But then, at the same way, that's not an awful lot different to what Gogol Bordello are doing, I guess. They might call it gypsy punk, and there may be a much stronger sort of Eastern European Romani influence rather than Central European folk. But yeah, it seems like quite an odd thing. It'll probably get a reappraisal soon, and you'll see an article on Pitchfork, and it's going to be called Post Umparcore or something like that. But for the time being, it sounds just quite a bizarre idea. But yeah, these four tracks did really sort of cover the bases. There was stuff that was sort of more in tune with the sort of American hardcore punk stuff of the 80s. And yeah, as you say, some very traditional punk. I mean, the TNT one I thought was more like something like maybe like the Runaways or something, the poppy edge of punk.
Yeah.
And the Sperm one had a very sort of frenetic, scratchy DIY feel that you associate with a lot of punk.
It sort of feels chaotic and the energetic, but at the same time it was more oriented to these punk bands. I'm sort of regretting that I didn't put a Lilliput song, because Lilliput songs are really Dada-esque, you would say. They're like a collage for different things, and they were very they just brought this instrumentation, which was, you felt that they really didn't even know how to play their instruments too. And that was part of the charm, I would say.
That sounds very much like the Slits, what you hear.
Yeah,
there's that. Have they done a cover of I Heard It Through the Grapevine? Have they done that as well, or is it? No, okay. Sean,
no, they did.
The Slits did. I was wondering if if, you know, it was that kind of thing was big in Swiss punk as well. Sean, what did you think of these then?
I mean, I agree with you guys. I think it's actually a pretty decent smattering of, I guess what we've come to know as the, 77 leading into hardcore, leading into post-punk. I gotta be honest, I actually hadn't heard any of these bands before Juan sent the email. I guess if these bands had not, I mean, what kind of labels were these bands on? I mean, would they have been considered major in Switzerland?
No, I think some of them were from Box Pop Records, but most of these were released as split singles. They weren't really, yeah.
I mean, I just know the networking back then, you know, with a lot of punk music, especially with hardcore and then post-punk, a lot of it was word of mouth and performance-based. So if you weren't on a major back then, you were, you know, you were kind of confined to your region.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not particularly knowledgeable about the Swiss music scene in general, but I can't think of many, actually any, off the top of my head, sort of Swiss artists who have broken out into the what you'd call the UK or US mainstream. So perhaps there's these scenes going on that you just don't sort of find out about because they've got the major label backing. It ends up being quite insular, perhaps. I'm probably being, again, grossly unfair to some very, very good Swiss musicians who are just, I'm not aware of.
You're definitely much more capable of finding this stuff now, you know, obviously, because, you know, the world's at our fingertips now.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Back when these bands probably could have made more of an impact, unfortunately. You know, everything was paper flyers, zines, and, you know, your catalogs were like a sheet of paper, and you had to know a label to kind of be able to, I guess, tap a resource like this.
Yeah, it's all interesting stuff. That, I mean, as I say, it's, you know, I'm glad Juan brought it to my attention. It's not the sort of thing I would have sought out myself. And also, the, you know, I thought I hadn't heard of any of this stuff, but some of the YouTube videos that we were directed towards, they had sort of 30, 35 views. It's really sort of not particularly celebrated. There's that one website which I meant to make a note of, now I've forgotten. Was it where all these bands are mentioned? Is it swisspunk.ch or something like that?
Yeah, swisspunk.ch. That's a pretty good reference for anyone who wants to learn a little bit about swisspunk. It's sort of difficult to navigate because you try to hit the English translation and then it goes back to its native language and it just goes back and forth. And in a way, that's part of the difficulty because there's not much, even if we know about these bands, there's not much besides these websites that you would learn about swisspunk. I know that there's a book called Hot Love, which is something that I really want to pick up now because it apparently goes through this whole movement in chronological order, and now it's really hard to find the book as well. So it's probably going to go for a few bucks.
It's quite unusual in this day and age. As Sean said, we've got the world at our fingertips, but to still find something which is actually relatively difficult to track down and learn more about actually makes it more appealing, I think, now.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay, I think
that
might
be also... I'm sorry, I was going to say Lilliput, I know, had a distribution through Kill Rock Stars. So, I mean, I can understand why they're probably the best known.
Yeah.
How well known were they? I'm gonna again show my ignorance and say I'd never heard of them before. So did they? What kind of exposure did they get?
Pitchfork likes them.
Pitchfork likes them.
I know. Recently, Kill Rock Stars actually tried to reissue the Kleenex Lilliput. They have a compilation out, and it's like everything. And I think they had a they were doing. My name's escaping me now. They were basically where you can donate online.
Oh, what, just like a fan-funded release?
Yeah, a fan-funded vinyl cop release. They were actually going to do a very a pretty special package, but I don't know if they ever got properly funded for it. But I remember there being a, kind of a call for people to you know if you're a fan of this band, open your wallet and you can have this awesome edition of this album.
So the master tapes are all sort of there and ready to go, are they? It's just a case of actually putting it all together.
Yeah, I mean, the compilation exists anyway. You can buy it at Kill Rock Stars. I just think it's CD as opposed to, you know, special vinyl.
I guess we'll wrap things up there. I'd like to thank Juan and Sean for joining me today, and thank you, of course, for listening. For reviews, music features, and film reviews and features, we are always at noripcord.com, and also you can follow us on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/noripcordmagazine, and we're also on Twitter, twitter.com/noripcord. And the only thing that remains for me to say, really, is that we have a winner in our Your New Favorite Band competition from the last month. So congratulations to Miracle Parade, who won this month's vote, and you'll be played out by the sounds of their song, The Dying Physicist. So until next time, thank you very much for listening.